May 23rd. Lag BaOmer. Okay, I would like to, before going on to the next section of what we want to talk about, following the legacy book of Rabbi Wein, Rabbi Goldstein, I want to just finish one idea from last week in terms of its ways are the ways of pleasantness and the idea of trying to do an attitude of trying to do what is right. And it deals with money. It deals with money. An attitude towards money. I venture to say, and I don't think that it's a big secret, that in general, Western society's attitudes towards money is not a healthy one. Okay, it's the be-all and end-all of everything in life, and that doesn't lead to good things. And when the Almighty grants money, or a lot of money, to some people, they don't know what to do with it, that can destroy their lives and destroy other lives. Rabbi Yerucham Levavitz, he passed away in the 1930s. He was one of the great Musar masters, of his generation, and he was the spiritual guide, the Mashkiach, in the Mir Yeshiva, he wrote many, many great books on Musar. He says as follows, and this continues from what we were speaking about at the end of last week. He says, when one enters a court of law, he says a Beis Din, he's talking about two Jews entering a Beis Din in litigation regarding money. He says, this is how he says, what ideally would be a person's approach and a person's mindset when entering litigation. How can I rid of myself of any doubt that I may have someone else's money in my possession? And if it's mine, it's mine. And if it's his, it's his. But the idea is not, I'm in here to win. The idea is, I'm coming into the litigation to make sure that whatever God wants in his Torah that this money should belong to, that is the way that it's decided. And therefore, the Mishnah elsewhere writes, in Avos, that when two people come into a litigation in front of the judge, they're like wicked people. But when they leave, they're both, because each one is making a claim that the other one is wrong, so one of them is not right. But when they leave, the Mishnah says that they should both be in your eyes like righteous people if they've accepted the judgment upon themselves. Right? Because then, even if one had made an incorrect assessment and thought the money was his, if he's willing to accept that which the judge says as the Torah law, right, then he's a righteous person. So that's one idea. And then Rabbi Yerucham writes that justice is found by glimpsing at the other person's plights, needs, and opinions. That doesn't mean they're right, but by seeing another side. By seeing another side means, okay, I can still think that I'm right, but I'm having a conversation. It's one of the things that plagues our society today, right? That I'm not willing to even think that the other person has an opinion, or the right to an opinion, or to listen to the other person's opinion, and to say, I disagree with you. I can see where you're coming from, or sometimes, if it's so extreme, I might not even, I don't even think that that's right, but to give another person a chance at an opinion. I'm personally struggling myself with how far does this go? How far does this go? Does it go when it comes to denial of God? I can hear people denying it. Do I have to listen to it? Do I have to pay heed to it? So I don't know the answer offhand. I'm trying to work out how to define an answer to that question. How long do I have to listen? Or how far do I have to listen? But the idea that the Mishnah says that jealousy, desire, lust, and the desire for honor remove a person from this world, right? That means it doesn't allow a person to enjoy life. What you have is always mine. I want what you have. No. Seeing the other person's plight, seeing the other person's needs, and understanding that God puts different things in place gives a person a certain serenity and allows a person a certain menuchas ha-nefesh, a certain serenity and peace of mind that Rabbi Yerucham says is the crown of all good traits. Peace of mind, serenity is the crown of all good traits. Okay. It's difficult to come by. Peace of mind is not so easy to come by. And you know, people say, easier said than done. Yeah, that's right. Anything worthwhile in life is easier said than done. So saying things is easy. Okay. The next part that we want to delve into in terms of midos and in terms of living a life of derecheho darchei noam, that its ways, the ways of the Torah, are ways of pleasantness, is something that we call menschlichkeit. Okay? To be a mensch. What does it mean? What does it mean to be a mensch? So I printed over here, I printed out a number of things, of source materials, and the first one comes, actually, it's not from a Torah source, it's from the Joy of Yiddish. It's just a very, very general statement. There's not a lot of depth to it, but at least to start with, it's something to think about. A mensch is someone to admire and emulate, someone of noble character. The key to being a real mensch is nothing less than character, rectitude, dignity, a sense of what is right, responsible, and decorous. Okay, it doesn't have a lot of detail in terms of fine-tuning it. The funny thing is that I'm not positive, but I believe that the word mensch has made its way into the English language. I know that a lot of people use it. There isn't really an English translation for it. I mean, maybe there is, but what?
Mensch on a bench, they sell us little guys.
I got one. Sure.
Okay, let's see what the Mishnah in Ethics of Our Fathers has to say about this. We'll stick with the English. Rabbi Hanina ben Dosa says, anyone whose fear of sin precedes his wisdom endures. Because if you have wisdom, but it precedes your fear of sin, so your wisdom, you know, that which I know intellectually, is not always going to keep me in place. I don't know if you've ever in your life experienced this, where you know something is right to do, but you haven't done it. Has that ever happened to you? Right? Now, fear of sin is no guarantee. But having yiras chet, having fear of sin, knowing that I have a judge to answer to, and knowing that I'm responsible for my actions, oftentimes keep my wisdom, my wisdom endures, and it stays within me. But someone whose wisdom precedes his fear of sin, so he knows everything. We have a lot of people about, you know, what was it, in Columbia or one of the big universities in New York, where this ethics professor was caught in a big immoral scandal, and then when his students questioned him about it, he said, I don't understand. Just because I'm teaching mathematics, do I have to be a triangle? Right? So if I'm teaching ethics, doesn't mean I have to be an ethical person. I have the knowledge, and this is what I teach, and that's, you know, that's where I am. Right? Yeah, because Baruch Atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech Haolam Shehakol Nehyeh Medvarei.
Amen.
So here, this didn't deal directly with Derech Eretz, but these two things direct with being a mensch. The next Mishnah, which comes also from Ethics of Our Fathers, Pirkei Avos, speaks about something. Now here, there's a question what the word Derech Eretz means. If somebody tells a child, you have to have Derech Eretz, means you have to behave properly. You have to have proper etiquette, you have to have proper manners, you have to behave in a dignified fashion, which we'll discuss. But in our Mishnah here, there's a question if that's what the Mishnah means over here, because Derech Eretz, literally translated, means the way of the world. It could also mean working for a living. Okay? So the Mishnah says, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah says, if there's no Torah, there's no worldly occupation. I mean, there's no Torah to guide you on how to behave in business, so then your business is probably not that it's not going to make money, but it's not going to do well in the things that are important. But on the other side, if there's no worldly occupation, also it could mean that if there's no Torah, so the world is not going to continue, so there's no jobs out there, because the world is not here. But the next thing is, if there's no worldly occupation, there is no Torah, which means there has to be both sides. There have to be people working, and there have to be people studying and involved in the study of Torah, and there has to be a balance. But I want to talk about, because I think it fits very much into this idea of using the term Derech Eretz and using the term Menschlichkeit, if we were speaking the Jewish vernacular, a mensch is not a Hebrew word, it's a Yiddish word. Derech Eretz is a Hebrew word. Okay, Derech Eretz, literally translated, means the way of the world. Again, it's translated as proper behavior, etiquette, being a mensch, etc., and many things are included in that. The Maharal of Prague points out that when it's referred to in this way, it's not called Derech Olam. What does Olam mean?
World.
The world. It's not called the way of the world. It's called Derech Eretz, the way of the land. In general, when we talk about the world, even though in theory you could say it's talking about the universe as a whole, when we speak about the world, we talk about planet Earth. When we speak about Eretz, about land, we usually talk about inhabited places, where people live, right? Where you have to interact with other human beings. Says the Maharal, the fact that the Mishnah and the Midrash, which we'll quote a little bit later, speaks about the that we have to have Derech Eretz, means that the Torah is not requiring of us to sit somewhere out in a place where there are not people and be one with nature, be one with the world, and get along with the world, and maybe even behave like the animals. No, that's not what the Torah wants. The Torah wants us to be with people in a place that's inhabited, and despite all the challenges, and there are many, that being around other people confront us with, there is where you have to behave like a mensch. Okay? So to run away from society sometimes may be a solution, but at best a temporary solution. The example that I like to give is you have a person doing teshuva, and he has a neighbor, and he can't stand the neighbor, and he yells at the neighbor, and he curses the neighbor, and he does terrible things to the neighbor. And he realizes that he's behaving in an improper way. So what he does is, the neighbor's name is Stern, his name is Goldberg. Goldberg moves to Juneau, Alaska. Right? And then, that's his teshuva. He's going away from the situation. Well, that's one way of avoiding it. But the reality is he hasn't conquered his problem. He's avoiding it. Until the next day he reads in the headline, Stern buys oil pipeline in Juneau, Alaska. Right? Then he's faced with the problem again. Meaning, there can be an element in tshuva, in improving your character, trying to avoid a situation for a while so that you try to come to grips with it. But that ultimately, Derech Eretz means to live amongst the land, the inhabited land, and there becoming a mensch in that environment, and living like a mensch in that environment. Now, Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, of blessed memory, in his commentary on the Torah, has a fascinating insight into this. Because there's a very well-known Jewish saying, that is number 6 on this page. It's on the second column. It's number 6. You see it's on the right, it's on the column on the right. It's source number 6. It's in light print. It's the 5th or 6th line on the page. Okay? Personification of virtue, one aspect of Derech Eretz. I should say of Derech Eretz. Okay? In the Talmud and Midrash. Midrash is more of the homiletic part of the teachings that come from the era of the Mishnah and the Talmud. There are approximately 200 teachings concerning Derech Eretz, which is what we're speaking now, we're translating as Menschlichkeit, as decent, polite, respectful, thoughtful, and civilized behavior. One representative teaching is that Derech Eretz comes before Torah. This is a very famous saying for those who've studied. Derech Eretz kadma l'Torah, Derech Eretz, way of the world, Menschlichkeit precedes Torah. Now, what does that mean? First of all, we'll see in a moment, it's an incorrect quote. The whole world quotes it, but it's a quote that comes as a result of something else, which we'll see now. But what does it mean it comes before? Does that mean you have to be a mensch before you study Torah? Well, first of all, you'll never get around to studying Torah. a lot of these things. Because, oh, I have to do that first, and I'll ignore the other stuff while I'm doing this. You never get around to a lot of stuff that way, right? Okay. So, but it comes from a teaching that I thought I had copied here, but I don't. And Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky quotes it, and I'm sorry that it's not on here. The teaching is that when God created Adam and Eve, He gave them the concepts of Derech Eretz, of being a mensch. 26 generations later, when the Torah was given at Sinai, that is when, so to speak, Torah came into the world. According to that understanding, what it means is that chronologically, Derech Eretz preceded the Torah. It's a totally different way of looking at it. Derech Eretz precedes Torah, or it's before. But the truth is that if God gave it first, that means there had to be that existence in order for the Torah to have something to go into. This is a totally ridiculous example, but if I have coffee, a delicious coffee, and I really would like it, and it's terrific, and I have a mug, and the mug is full of mud and other junk, and I don't have anything to put it into, so the coffee is worthless, right? You have to have a mug, and you have to have a mug that doesn't have a terrible taste. So then either the mug is empty, or it has something else in it, it has water, then you can put the coffee into it. But if it's full of junk, so it has no place to go. So too, the Torah could only be given once mankind had a sense of menschlichkeit. That was the mug that holds holds the good thing that I'm about to put in. Right? So without that, without Derech Eretz, the Torah has nothing to go into. God is not interested in teaching the Torah as an intellectual pursuit into somebody who is so corrupt and such a disgusting person that we're going to teach them Torah. That's not what it is. The Torah is supposed to take a person who is working on their midos, on their character traits, on being a mensch, and refine them and teach them, again, how do we even improve that? What the Torah really says a mensch is, what really Derech Eretz is, because as we spoke about last week, that society's understanding of civility and politeness and, you know, and having nice manners is very different oftentimes than what the Torah says is proper behavior. So, out of this teaching, that Derech Eretz precedes Torah, comes comes from this medrash that says that God gave Adam and Eve the concept of midos and Derech Eretz and good character, and then they worked on that. They failed, they were successful. You don't have to be 100% successful, but it's something that God taught humanity. And then 26 generations later, He gave the Jewish people the Torah. Says Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, remember last week, it was more or less in passing, but we mentioned that the Talmud and other sources call the book of Genesis, Sefer Bereishis, Sefer HaYoshar, the book of the straight ones. Why? Because we said that the patriarchs were Yesharim, that we're supposed to learn from them on how to behave like a mensch, which is one of the reasons why you would think the Torah is a law book. What are all these stories? The stories are supposed to teach us human frailty, human greatness, and how to behave. What are some of the great midos that we're supposed to learn from Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, and the matriarchs? We have a story in Bereishis, says Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, a very interesting story. Lot is Abraham's nephew. Abraham's father, Terach, had a brother, Haran. Haran had a son, Lot. He also had, apparently, Sarah was also Avram's niece, but that's neither here nor there for this part of the discussion. And Lot was raised by Abraham and Sarah. He was raised by Avram and Sarah. Eventually, Lot goes away, and he chooses the life of wealth, riches, and immorality over living with Abraham. He goes to Sodom and Gomorrah. Sodom and Gomorrah then destroyed by God. Right? Then there's another story, where after that, the four kings versus the five, there are kings who go to war, and they capture Lot. Now, Avraham Avinu is in a quandary. He has his nephew Lot, who left him and abandoned him, and apparently in many ways abandoned the way of life that Avraham Avinu tried to raise him with, in some ways. And now, he's captured. Avraham gets together a small army. He risks his life, and he goes to recapture Lot, to redeem him. Abraham goes to war and he's successful, and he gets Lot back. Says Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, by Jewish law, once the Torah came along, you are not. If Avram Avinu would have gone to the rabbi and said, "Rabbi, my nephew was captured. Am I required to try to go and save him?" The rabbi might have said no. I just looked up the halacha. There's actually, believe it or not, in the Shulchan Aruch, in the Code of Jewish Law, that it has nothing to do with Lot and Avram. There is actually a section of the law that speaks about if somebody's taken captive, what we are required to do in order to save him. The halacha is we're required to go get him, not that we could sit back. And you know, he got himself into trouble. No, I have to go and save him. The question then becomes, if your life is in danger, are you then also required? And there you have a dispute amongst the commentaries. One of the commentaries say, you're only in doubt that your life is in danger by going there. His life is for certain in danger, so therefore you're required to go. Others say you're not required to endanger your life to that extent. Imagine, there's such a law, that the Shulchan Aruch discusses this. But Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky says, that had Avraham Avinu asked a rabbi in his time whether to go, if he would have asked him after the Torah was given, maybe he would have had to go, maybe not. But in his day, that Derech Eretz preceded Torah as a law of Derech Eretz, because Lot helped him so much in the previous years, and he owed a debt of gratitude to Lot. And Lot was his family, as far as being a mensch and doing the right thing, Avraham did that. That's an amazing thing. That teaches us over there how powerful the concept of Derech Eretz and being a mensch is. This was the menschlich thing for Avraham Avinu to do, to go and rescue Lot from that situation, because he was his flesh and blood, because he at one time in his life had helped spread the name of Hashem, like Avraham Avinu when he was together with Avram, and therefore Avraham Avinu was required to do so. Once the Torah is given, sometimes, for instance, you'll have a law of menschlichkeit and a law that overlap. For instance, washing hands before eating. Certainly, let's say before eating bread, but before eating in general. The world out there, maybe in America we have hygiene. The world, they say, you know, that they blame the Jews for the plagues, the black plagues. You know, Jews are the last ones. They were the most hygienic of all the peoples. People didn't take baths and shower summers for a year. For a year. It wasn't like that in the Jewish world. As a matter of fact, I remember something just popped into my head. I haven't thought about this in a long time. In the early 1990s, Rabbi Shlomo Goldberg, who today has a huge school system in Los Angeles, he spoke at a yeshiva parlor meeting here, and I remember him telling a story of Rabbi Yisrael Spira, the Blujava Rebbe, Bergen-Belsen, or one of the other camps that he was in. He, even though he got such a small, tiny ration of water every week he put a little bit aside to wash his shirt from his concentration camp uniform, so he could hold his dignity. You know, so he should go around with what was clean clothing. You understand that it wasn't clean. But he didn't want to lose the concept of retaining his menschlichkeit and his dignity even in that situation. What a powerful idea. So let's say washing hands before eating bread. So it's both halacha and it's a menschlich thing to do. You're going to eat. You should wash your hands. So sometimes they overlap. It could be that at once the Torah is given, if by doing what you think is menschlichkeit violates the law of the Torah, so the Torah law would seem takes precedence over what you might think is a menschlich thing to do. It's for one of two reasons. Either because my value system of what the thing to do may be skewed, but even if I don't understand it, and even if I don't think it's skewed, you can't just violate halacha. I mean, there are, of course, exceptions to the rule, but in general, you can't violate halacha because you don't think it fits into your box. Okay? Another idea of menschlichkeit. Let's take a look at what the... continue in number 6. We said there are over 200 teachings, approximately 200 teachings concerning Derech Eretz as decent, polite, respectful, thoughtful, and civilized behavior. One representative teaching is that Derech Eretz comes before Torah. You see the source that he brings, Midrash Rabbah, Vayikra 9:3. That's the source that I mentioned to you before, that says that Derech Eretz Menschlichkeit came 26 generations before the giving of the Torah. So it doesn't actually say those words. Derech Eretz comes before Torah. It just said that God gave Adam and Eve this, and then 26 generations later came the giving of the Torah. One cannot personify Torah until he demonstrates Derech Eretz in everything that he does. There are many more such teachings in the Rishonim and Achronim post-Talmudic authorities. The Musar literature, in fact, presents an entire body of thought devoted to the subject of character traits and behaving like a mensch. Here, the way that one behaves is regarded as an external manifestations of one's character. So the way one behaves as a mensch is representative of what's going on inside the person. Okay? Now, these things that we're going to say now deal with menschlichkeit. They don't deal with midos. They don't deal with character, but they're representative. Let's see. Under the general rubric of Derech Eretz, and he says over here, if you saw before, one has to teach children from a young age these things. The sages caution us against overeating, gluttony, right? Eating too quickly, or staring at someone else who's eating. It's just not a nice thing to do. Right? Also, one should not talk too loudly or too much, and should greet people pleasantly. This is all part of being a mensch. There's nothing that you can say. Where does it say it in the Torah? There is nothing, right? It's being a mensch. Likewise, a person with Derech Eretz is careful to spend only what they can afford. You don't overspend what you can't afford. In order to raise children with Derech Eretz, it's important not to spoil them by accustoming them to have delicacies or expensive toys or so on. You spoil them by doing that. You are teaching them not to be a mensch by giving them everything that they want. Okay? Grandparents are exempted from this. Not really, but to some extent. In general, to have Derech Eretz usually means to live ethically, responsibly, and with dignity, and to be considerate of others. So I want to share with you a couple of things, just that I thought might be of interest. There's one more source I don't think we'll get to, but I want to share with you a couple of things. It's right here. Rav Moshe Feinstein wrote, it was the greatest halachic authority of our time. Born in Russia, he came to the United States in the late 30s, maybe in 1940. He died in 1986, I believe. And amongst the voluminous things that he wrote, the most well-known is something called Igros Moshe, which means the letters of Moshe. Thousands upon thousands of questions that people asked him, and he responded in writing. And because he passed away in 86, but up until that time, every modern question and every medical question and ethical question and Shabbos question, everything, he was just like, I would not exaggerate if I told you that Rabbi Feinstein of blessed memory had the equivalent knowledge, just, I'm talking about book knowledge, I'm not talking about the depth of his character. If I were to tell you that he knew the entire Encyclopedia Britannica by heart, word for word, Reb Moshe knew more than that. Okay? His student, who passed away a few years ago, Reb Ephraim Greenblatt from Memphis, once came to Reb Moshe in New York, and whenever he would visit him, I mean, they had phones back there, but it wasn't regular to make long-distance calls. Whenever he would come to New York, he would have his most difficult halachic queries, questions, and he would ask Rabbi Feinstein these questions. He once came to him with a whole slew of questions, and Reb Moshe just answered them with quoting sources and so on, and he would write everything. Reb Ephraim Greenblatt went, and he checked out everything that Reb Moshe said to make sure that he was accurate, not in the answer, but in the sources that he was quoting, because if he's quoting the sources incorrectly, then maybe the answer is inaccurate. Every single one was to the T exactly what he said. So he went back to him, and he said, how is that possible? I just asked you the most difficult questions, right? And you, every source you knew. So he said to him, Ephraim, when you studied the Code of Jewish Law over 600 times, well, you'll know it like me too. And that was years before he passed away. I remember much his mind is unbelievable. I had an experience like that once. I remember the whole ABC by heart. No, I remember. I had an experience 25. Like this once. At the time I was 25. I had an experience like this once where I was in Jerusalem, and Rabbi Eliashiv, who was a contemporary of Rabbi Feinstein, Rabbi Eliashiv passed away 6 years ago. I've spoken about him frequently. He was also that kind of a person who spent, he lived to be 102, and his mind was clear until the end. And he spent 100 years of his life, 95 years, learning. He also asked questions, answered questions. So before he turned about 90, he would daven in the Meir Sha'arim section of Yerushalayim every morning. And one morning I went to daven with him. And they have, at the side, he sat in the front, at the side they had those big windows, like, you know, the old windows, also with the large ledges on the window. So he would take off his tefillin, and he would put the tefillin bag on the window, and he would take off and he would wrap up his tefillin. So after davening, it was an incredible thing. People walked into shul, and people who were in the shul, and the people who would record what he said, both verbally, they would record with a little tape recorder, and with a little notebook. And they went there, and they were like three high. The people were standing on chairs, and then people on their shoulders, and they were asking him questions, and he was just, you know, spitting out the answers. And these were the most complex, difficult, medical, legal questions, monetary questions. And it was a funny thing. I stayed in my seat and was just watching this unfold. One of his secretaries, the rabbi who had taken notes on what he said, on the way he was walking out of shul, I said to him, what question was, it took about 5-6 minutes, and this happened every day after davening. They would get questions from all over the world, back then by fax, by thing, you know. And he would, so I said, what question did he answer? So he looks at me, he says, what question did he answer? He just covered the entire 4 sections of the code of Jewish law. You know, like, what question did he answer? He was all over the place, and he just had this in his mind. So Rav Moshe Feinstein, very interesting over here. I'm going to show you a word. You won't know it. It says Be'inyan. You won't recognize that, but it says hypnotism.
Yeah,
I can read it. He's asked about hypnosis in halacha. Are you allowed to do hypnosis? So I'm going to tell you a personal story. Anybody here been to the Wisconsin Dells? It's a vacation spot in Wisconsin. It's not a vacation spot in the winter, I don't think. You can't see, you can't feel your nose in the winter. You know? It's very, but in the summer, it's a vacation spot. They have the Dells, they have boats, old army boats, and you go on the water, and they have lots of amusement parks. I've, a couple of times as our kids were growing up, we took them there on vacation for a few days in the winter, in the summer, and it was a lot of fun. One night, when the parks and stuff are closed, so I did something that I've never done in Denver, and I said to Chai, look, they have a hypnosis show over here. Let's go inside. It's a show, and it says it's for all ages. Excuse me, I'm very dry. So, we went inside. Lo and behold, you go inside, and they ask for volunteers. So, I said, I'm volunteering. He says, don't! Huh? Yeah, yeah, you, to me or to him, you would have said it. Anyway, because I'm the genius in the family, I didn't listen to her. And I went up on stage, and there were about 60 of us, 40 to 60 chairs on stage, and we sat there, and they went through the first round of trying to get people under. Right? And some people were, you know, fell into this hypnotic state. Others, like me, like weren't affected at it at all. So they already know the game. So those who they thought that wouldn't work, right? So they said, please get off the stage. Thank God. I got off the stage, right? Then they went through another round, another selection, and they got rid of a few more, and they were left with many 20 people, men and women on the stage. I got to tell you, hypnosis is real, ladies and gents. I mean, you know, what they made these people do on stage, it was crazy. At one moment, they were dancing like Michael Jackson, even people who couldn't dance. Another time, they said it was so hot, people started, it was a children's show. So they only allowed them to take off so much clothing until they said, you know, stop, you know. Then they had them that it was freezing and people were going around hugging each other. You know, I understand the men were hugging the women. Everyone was hugging each other to keep warm. I'm glad Chaya told me not, you know. I'm so glad I was smart enough not to listen to her. I mean, I would have been a fool. I would have been an idiot, right? And the people up there are fools, but Rav Moshe has asked the question over here about hypnosis. Are you allowed to undergo hypnosis? But the title of the thing that he answers is, are you allowed to undergo medical hypnosis? So Rav Moshe says that he looked into it and he did research on hypnosis, and he says that if it's for medical reasons, you're allowed to. But, he says, be careful with the doctor who you do it with, because there are a lot of unruly and immoral people out there, and once they do hypnosis on you, then they can do anything with you that they want. And also, he says, not to do it just for recreation, is what I did, which if I would have read this first, maybe I would you make an idiot out of yourself? Why? Forget about the hugging the women part, whatever, when you called it. Let's leave that. What was wrong with it? The answer is, it's beneath our dignity. It's not being a mensch. To go up and to make a total fool where people are not laughing with you, people are laughing at you, that's... I know society is into that. The Torah teaches us that's not being a mensch. And those are not the types of things that we should do. Okay? So I just found this a fascinating thing. When it comes to menschlichkeit, there are certain things that society accepts. Like, I'll tell you another thing. You ever see a hot dog eating contest?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, I'm sorry for saying, because it's not, they stuff their faces. That's not being a mensch. That's not having Derech Eretz. I didn't do anything wrong. I can imagine. I made a bracha. No. That's not being a mensch. That's not a dignified way of eating. The Torah wants us to be dignified because one of the ideas is that the way that we behave outwardly, if we're being a mensch, expresses the midos that are going on inside. Right? And those need to be worked on. I'll tell you another example. Society has lowered the bar so terribly in our time that some people can't even relate to this. That's why everybody in this class has to be over 25 years old. Right? You take a can of soda. So, by the way, there were places that felt drinking straight from the can and straight from the bottle is also improper. But, all right, I was drinking from the bottle, so I can't say that, right? But you take a thing and you chug down the whole thing in one shot, one gulp, 12 ounces. It's not dignified. Is anything wrong with it? The question is not, is there something wrong with it? That's when the Torah tells us, even in the midst of Kedoshim Tiyu, you should be holy, or being a mensch. It's not a question of right and wrong. It's a question of having a self-sense of dignity. In yeshivas, they would have a higher level of that. For instance, we think today throwing something on the street is not proper, right? Because it's not good for the environment. But 50 years ago, they didn't talk that way. Until, you know, still there are places that are filthy, and it's not right.
They had but an old commercial with the Indian, remember? He would, like, cry up.
It's, yeah.
Like a famous commercial, I forgot.
In yeshivas, like Aaron Kotlov, he would see somebody drops a piece of paper on the floor, so he would say, that's not being a mensch. And he says, it's not just because it makes the floor dirty, but where, he said, and it's not just because this is disrespect for God's house, for a shul, or for a yeshiva. He was talking about in the yeshiva. He said, what kind of respect is that? Your friend lives here, your friend stays here. What kind of respect does that show to your friend by throwing something on the floor? I had another personal experience, but this one, I was there, but it didn't involve me personally. And I remember when I was in the yeshiva in Stamford, Connecticut, they did not allow smoking. I was never a smoker. Just now, I'm still shocked. Just now, I came back from Israel last week. Oh, man. Terrible how much they still smoke there. They didn't get the memo. I don't know. Maybe their Sturgeon General didn't warn them. I don't know. it's just terrible. But I remember when I was in yeshiva, also there, lots of boys smoked. Thank God, in the yeshivas where I studied, they didn't allow them to smoke in the building, in the study hall, or in the room where the classes took place. But in Israel, they didn't allow smoking in the building at all. Lots of them smoked outside, and you'd see cigarette butts all over the place. Right? What kind of dignity is that? There's an ashtray. There's a garbage bag. Put it like it, just not nice. But I remember that when I was in Stamford, Connecticut, in the yeshiva there, I was there in 1982 and 83 before I got married. The Rosh Yeshiva, the head of the yeshiva, a great man, he spoke about it once. He said, look, smoking is not good. He certainly didn't smoke. But if you smoke, don't throw the cigarette butt on the floor. It's not menschlichkeit. Right? Besides, he said, this is a yeshiva. This is a holy place. Okay. The next day, literally the next day, we had one of the students in the yeshiva had gotten married that week. And in the yeshiva luncheon lunchroom, they had a Sheva Brachas party for the bride and the groom who came, you know. And I remember right before, it was the middle of the day, we had a very fancy lunch that day because the bride and the groom were there, and we all went to wash our hands. So we're waiting on line by the sink. So there was the father of the groom, who was a prestigious guy from England. And then there was the Rosh Yeshiva, and then was me and a couple of other boys. And as the father of the groom is going to wash, he takes the cigarette out of his mouth, puts it on the floor, and steps on it. And like the Rosh Yeshiva is standing in front of us, and he goes, he just shrugs his shoulders, what should I say? But it left such like, it's especially after that talk, it seemed so undignified. You can't always put your finger on what it is, but when you see it, you know it. In some societies, you know it more. In some societies, you know it less. In yeshivas, they considered, let's say, there in all yeshivas, there are signs. When you take out a book, return it to its place. Return it to the shelf. We don't have it here. They don't leave it out so much. I usually go and put that. Why? So the Rosh Yeshiva used to explain, there's two things. First of all, we don't have an endless source of books. So if somebody's looking for the same book of you and you don't put it back, and then if you don't put it back in its right place, nobody will know where to find it. That's why they're usually color-coded and other things in the yeshivas. All the books are color-coded and sometimes numbered, so you know what shelf they belong on. But they would say it's not being a mensch. Leaving something out, leaving it there for somebody else to put away. You used it. You benefited from it. Right? Children should be raised the same way. You know, after a certain age, you're at the table, you eat dinner, why does mommy have to clean up? Or daddy have to clean up? At least if you're saying, okay, mommy does the dishes, the dishwasher does the dishes, the cleaning lady, it's good to train them. Pick up your plate and put it into the sink. Yeah? Again, different societies, different households, different things, but there's such a thing as being a mensch. So you have, first you have proper behavior, which is being a mensch. Then we'll go into next week, Mitzvah Hashem, which is good midos, good character traits, which is the internal part of bringing out the menschlich card. All this is what, it's all included in the mitzvah of the Torah called the Halachta Bedroch of going his way. Going in the ways of God, of being kind, being nice, we'll discuss that more. And this overall is included again in what we started with last week, Deroche HaDarche Noam. Its ways are ways of pleasantness. That's what the Torah is trying to create with us. A pleasant person, both in terms of being a mensch, in terms of midos, in terms of our interactions with other people. That way, all the Torah that we study has a utensil, a vessel, which to fall into and help us become even greater. Okay, thank you.